Welcome to the CEN show, the voice of the world community. On Monday, Professor Ra taught on Kwanzaa, and it was a very good show. And I'm going to show everybody how you can access that. So here's the video on YouTube. Was a very good show, very good information about Kwanzaa. And then also here's the podcast on the website, Community Education Network. You go to podcast and it's the last show on there that we did. So that's an audio. And it's real good information about Kwanzaa. It is a celebration. And I encourage everybody to check those shows out so you can get that information. I also want to encourage everybody to check out the Carl Nelson show when they get time. I was listening to Professor James Smalls on two different occasions. If you just put Carl Nelson show in your search engine, and it'll come up. The archives for Carl Nelson show, and you can, he has many great guests, but I really encourage everybody to check out Professor James Smalls. He had two shows on here late. Okay. I would like to introduce myself. I am Rosaki Mascani. I'm your host this evening. And I would like to introduce the panel. We have Professor Amin Ra. We got Sister Linda Shorter. We got Brother Mashinda. And tonight's guest is Dr. Charles Alexander. He's a licensed clinical psychologist. And I'm going to interview him this evening. I'm going to interview him. I just have a few questions for him. Normally, when we do this, I like to get about at least 6 or 7 questions in, but I rarely do. So I only came up with 3 questions so we can get the panel involved. So, I met Brother Charles, Dr. Charles Alexander, about a month ago on our show with Brother Kwabena. He's an associate of Brother Kwabena's, and I immediately said I need to get this brother on the show after he introduced himself. So I'm glad he came out this evening to enlighten us with his great information. So I'm gonna go ahead and get started. First of all, I want to ask the brother how he's doing this evening. How you doing, Brother Dr. Charles Alexander?
I'm fine, brother, and thank you again for the invite. I'm glad to be here.
Excellent, excellent. So I'm gonna go ahead and get started here. Okay, when I was reading your bio, you have a very extensive background, educationally and professionally. And you currently provide the following services: psychological assessments, project management, program development and implementation, individual and group therapy, and strategic planning. Can you please give us an overview of these services?
Sure. So it's been my goal to be able to service the community, and so and to service the age range, and so or the life cycle, and so through a range of different service offerings, I'm able to do just that. And so again, so I provide individual therapy, group therapy, marital family therapies. I do program development and implementation. Quality assurance and clinical consultations. And I have office-based practice and also have contracts with the Chicago Public School System, where we provide coaching to the counselors and the teachers. And we're also negotiating, well, we've just negotiated a coaching contract with another suburban school. As well, similar to go in and coach social workers and teachers, help the teachers out with classroom management and things of that nature. And so between those range of services, again, therapy, coaching, project management, testing, we're able to touch, you know, the life cycle. So we have children as young as five that we're responsible for, all the way to seniors who are needing, you know, diagnostic assessments to assess for the effects of aging and things of that nature. And then just purely diagnostic testing anywhere on the continuum in between.
Okay. So you mentioned classroom management. I think that's a very important piece, and I want to talk to you offline about that. Okay. All right. Thanks for that. Okay. So why do you address the clinical needs of the traditionally underserved populations?
Exactly for that. Because, you know, just by definition, we need those services. We need those services in place. And by and large, that the underserved, you know, that underserved population is impacted by two things. Usually, there's a disparity. Even with the Affordable Care Act, there still remains a disparity in the Black community with regard to insurance and then, you know, adequate insurance. And depending on the quality of insurance or even just the access to insurance, you know, that will dictate what types of services that people can access and where they can access those services. And so knowing that, we have to be very intentional about where, you know, where we show up so that we can meet some of those needs. And again, you know, like even part of the strategy in going into the school systems, we're able to access funding from the schools that means that kids and in some situation parents can get services for FIFA services that are supplemented by the schools that don't require insurance or don't require, you know, private insurance. And one of the things that I was struck by, and this was back in 2001, Surgeon General David Satcher did a groundbreaking study on kind of the demographics of mental health. But one of the things that he found that was very profound in his research is that at that point, the majority of Black folks who were seeking services were presenting in emergency rooms for services. And so that is not an optimal way for anyone to obtain mental health services, because A, it's not going to be in any service, or it's not going to be any therapy. It's going to be an assessment to kind of determine whether or not that person needs to be admitted or not, whether or not that person is, to what degree that person is a harm to him or herself or the community. That's really what that service is for. And then if for some reason they determine that that person needs ongoing service or ongoing care, they do try to make some referrals for those folks, but they probably don't have services there for them. And so at best, people can go in and get emergency screenings, and they might be prescribed medication. And in those circumstances in which they are provided medication, they probably are not provided any kind of follow-up. And so we have a lot of circumstances in which our people fall through the cracks and fall, you know, and they don't get the adequate care. They don't get the adequate service. And so it really requires that we be very intentional in terms of our mental health delivery services and our efforts to build capacity so that there are multiple spaces in which the community can seek and access care.
That's really excellent that you know, providing these services for the underserved, because, man, we have I've worked at a high school, and we have a lot of children that need some help. And I, you know, I do the best I can, but I'm not a professional in that area. But that's
excellent. We have children, we have adults. I mean, it's across the lifespan. And I was looking at some numbers. I think the number is like 50% of 50% of both youth and adolescents and adults who have a diagnosed mental illness don't receive care. And so that's like 50% of Black folks who have a diagnosis don't receive ongoing care. And so again, A, we have to understand that the situation is that dire. And then B, we have to be willing to go into the community and find ways to meet the need.
That's good. That's excellent. Okay, so now I noticed you had another name that you go by. I want you to briefly tell us about your name and pronounce it for us, and then after that, you have this article out, or is it a paper article? It's the origin of Black historical trauma, and I didn't get a chance to read it all, but I read about half of it. Very interesting. So I would like for you to talk about those two things.
So my dissertation is on rites of passage. I came to Chicago to attend the Illinois School of Professional Psychology to study with who would become my mentor, Dr. Samila Abdullah. And I came to Chicago knowing that I wanted to write about rites of passage. And so she plugged me in with a brother named Kwa John Ziegler. And John Ziegler was had already been through an adult's rites of passage. And he and his partner, Brother Lewis, were implementing a life, rites of passage program at Harper High School, which is one of the high schools on the south side of Chicago. And he says to me, he says, you know, if you're going to write about rites of passage, have you been through a rites of passage? And I said, like, well, he said, you know, I pledged when I was in college, you know, so I have some idea of the concept. He said, but have you been through an African rites of passage? I said, no, I haven't. He said, so if you're going to write about this thing, you need to go through that. And so what has existed in Chicago since about 1992 or 93 is the INTU, International Institute of Rites of Passage. And in 95, I was able to be a part of one of the age groups to go through the rites, one of the adults age groups. And within that, and that rites of passage program is it was established by Dr. Nana Anthony Mensah, who was a brother from Ghana, and he was a member of the Akan. And so our rites of passage program is kind of predicated on the Akan traditions, but it incorporates a lot of different, you know, use a lot of different aspects of the various clans all over the continent, but it's fundamentally a con. But so within the context of that, there are three things that determine who you are, you know, within the context of the con framework. And the first thing is the day that the day that you're born, your day name. And so my day name is Kofi. So on Friday, September the 29th, 1967, I was born. And so I came into this world on a Friday, and that means I am a Kofi. And that means I'm an innovator. I'm an agent of change. Okay. And the next thing that determines, you know, who you are is what do the people say, and what do the people call you? And so my parents named me Charles Larson Alexander. Charles means man or manly. Larson means worthy of praise, and Alexander means defender of men. And in 96, we took a trip, the N2, we took a trip to Ghana, and we were visiting with Dr. Mensah, Nana Mensah, in Ghana, in Accra, and he gave me the name Achere. And Achere means it means guiding force and guiding light. And he told me that I would be someone that, you know, people would gravitate toward. I would be someone that people would listen to. I could give wise counsel and, you know, impact people, institutions, and so forth. And so I am Kofi Achere. And that gets to the third piece of establishing your identity is given the day that you're born and given what the people say, you know, how do you shape your myth? Do you live in that name? Do you walk in that space? And so as a psychologist, I would say I am living that destiny. I am an agent of change. I seek to be that agent of change, and I seek to engage our people in whatever way necessary in order to, again, kind of build capacity and meet the needs of the people as we meet them, as we find them, as we understand them. And so that's who Kofi Achere is.
Oh, that's beautiful. And you fit right in line with what we got going on here. Okay, that's beautiful. Thanks for that. Now, talk about this paper, man.
Okay.
Yeah.
So another thing. So it's another institution, longstanding institution in Chicago called the Communiversity. And through the years, the Communiversity has consisted of, you know, Baba J. Carruthers, Anderson Thompson, Brother Worrell, Bobby Wright, Kobe Cambone, and my teacher, R. Oldemenge O'Connor. And here lately, you know, he has been leading a resurgence in the work of the Communiversity, which essentially is a think tank. And he wanted to do he is doing an edited book on culture and trauma. And he asked that I contribute to that book. And trauma is a space that I work in pretty intentionally and pretty deeply. And through my engagement with the people, with the community, wherever I find us, one of the things that, you know, I've often had to contemplate, and one of the things that I continue to contemplate is, you know, when I come in contact with people and they say, you know, our culture or my history, it didn't start with slavery. And then I ask them, okay, well, tell me something about your life or your culture or your history prior to slavery. And, you know, most people can't. And so as I continue to, you know, contemplate and ponder that, one of the things that I kind of knew intuitively, and one of the things that, you know, I also knew because I love to read. I have just a voracious appetite for reading. That our trauma started before the transatlantic slave trade, and so when I was asked to contribute to this edited book, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to write about what was going on the continent that, you know, precipitated really the transatlantic slave trade. And so what I sent to you, brother, was the article that's going to go into this edited book, but this article is probably going to be the, you know, introduction or, you know, or perhaps the first chapter or what have you for probably what's going to become a book in and of itself. My plan is to, you know, starting with this information that we're going to get into, and then, you know, bring it to the transatlantic slave trade, bring it to our experience in, you know, in this thing we call the United States, and go from 1619 current with the continuous assaults on our character, on our person, that you know, has has left us traumatized. And so, in short, you know, just to get to this article, what I posit, you know, and this is predicated on the research, you know, long in place by Dr. Diop, Dr. Ben, Dr. Clark, Chancellor Williams, and borrowed pretty heavily from Dr. Ben and Chancellor Williams. And to start with Dr. Ben, you know, his take is that, you know, the onslaught and the destruction of Africa started with the Hyksos invasion of Egypt. And so that's, you know, some, you know, 1667 or something like that, BC. And then from that point forward, you know, you then have, after the Hyksos, you then have the Assyrians, then you have the Persians, then the Macedonians, then the Romans, and then the Arabs. And because of that constant pressure, we're pushed from Kemet back into Nubia, into Ethiopia, and then into the Sudan, and then further up across and to the West Coast. And through that time, we had the rise and fall of several kingdoms. And so within that, we have contact. Well, what's precipitating that, again, is the contact with these folks, you know, from Europe and Western Asia and Arabia. And because we have this contact, well, let's start with when, so like when we get into the Sudan and we get into like the ancient empire of Ghana, and you have contact with the Arabs. There's a decision made by leadership during that time that it's in the best interest of, you know, of the empire or whatever to go into business, you know, to do business with the Arabs. And so this starts off as just a business decision. And at a point it's determined that it might be advantageous for the people to start to practice Islam in the interest of trade. And so they start this trade, and the trade goes from, you know, probably, you know, goods and precious metals and things of that nature to trades and people. Now, prior to the slave trade, prior to the transatlantic slave trade, there was an indigenous system in which there was personal servitude. Now, in the indigenous system on the continent, typically folks who would end up in this system were folks who were, they were either criminals, or they were people who were impoverished otherwise and sold themselves into this status. Or, you know, they might have been prisoners of war, or they might even have had some debts to the community that they needed to pay. And so that's how people could find themselves in this position. And so that was one difference between that and what ultimately became the transatlantic slave trade. And then the other is that there was no form of this system on the continent that I am aware of from any of the studies that I've done in which that position was that's a lifelong designation, and that, you know, it was the same caste that followed the child, you know, that that, you know, any child born to the mother was necessarily a servant. It was not that type of peace. And even for those folks who found themselves in that situation, there are many times where those folks ultimately either were, you know, may have returned to, you know, wherever they came from, or, you know, became members of the communities or the, you know, the spaces in which they were doing their service. And so initially when the rulers start to engage in this bartering with the Arabs, again, it's under kind of the dictates that, you know, we're selling goods, then it gets involved, then we get involved with the trading of bodies. And at some point, the Arabs are not, you know, they're not satisfied with the terms. And so they start violating whatever the treaties are. And now they're engaging in raids and things of that nature. And they're also encouraging, you know, different people in the empire to engage in the same thing. And so you see this happen with several different empires. So Ghana, Mali, and Songhai. And so we move again, we start in Egypt, we get forced back to Nubia and Sudan, and then we have those successive empires. And each of those empires has some contact with the Arabs. And so it is in the context of that that we start to see the demise of, you know, of the African structure of community, right? Because one of the, you know, so what we see on the front end of this, you know, some of the terms that we hear now, and this is, you know, one of the things that I start to address in the document, like so we talk about the trauma of forced migration now. Right. So we talk about forced migration that's going on in let's look at South and Central America. So we have people who are coming and seeking asylum in the United States. And, you know, folks who are coming seeking asylum are by definition fleeing some type of political circumstance that has been determined not to be in their best interests. Okay. So that's considered forced migration. Well, I don't think we really consider what has gone on historically on the continent as that. And that's part of what I'm trying to draw people's attention to. And so, you know, so one of the first traumas that we see is what occurs when we are forced out of Kemet and back into Nubia and into the Sudan. That's a forced migration. So there are certain set of things that occur as a result of that. Then, again, once we start to have these relationships, these ongoing relationships with the Arabs, we then make some decisions in terms of, you know, our social and our religious order. We decide that we are going to start to practice Islam in the interest of commerce. Okay. So that's another trauma, right? We not only do we have this trade that goes into the theft of primarily women and children, and that's one of the primary differences between the Arab slave trade and the transatlantic slave trade, is that A, the Arab slave trade was longer, and it probably took more people. But in the Arab slave trade, it took primarily women and children, and most of the men who were involved became, you know, servants to the trade, you know, and they were castrated and they were made to do the bidding of the Arabs. And so all of that is traumatic. And again, but just the disruption of, you know, of a Ghanaian way of life you know, of a way of life in Mali, of a way of life in Songhe. All of that is just necessarily, it's disruptive and it's traumatic. And so we have this going on again from, you know, 1600 BC all the way to, to 600s, and that's where this kind of where this document goes. This document is going to go really just into that space, like 1600. I might take it to, it's really kind of that to the point at which we end up on the West Coast. And again, the conversation is about the amount of trauma that is occurring, you know, over that, you know, about 800 years, 1,000 years of pressure from the Arabs and other folks in Western Asia and the Mediterranean. And then ultimately, when I start to write again, I'm going to start to talk about the pressure from Europe and the Asiento. And so the Asiento is the contract that was drawn up by the Catholic Church, in which they broke a deal with Spain and Portugal to go and populate, you know, Central and South America and the Caribbean, and to also barter and steal Africans from the West Coast in order to do just that. And so all of those things are going on, and whatever is necessary for that to go on, you know, those things, all of that is going on before, before 1619 or whenever it is that the first slave ship lands here. We have the Portugal, we have the Portuguese and the Spaniards, probably on the west coast of Africa. I think in probably like 1300s or 1400s. So there was much groundwork that they were doing in order to kind of set this up prior to that eventual transatlantic slave trade. And so that's really what I'm dealing with in this article, is that all of the years of trauma that occurred as a result of our contact with, again, Arabs, Western Asia, Mediterranean, and then ultimately Europe. And in each of those cases, not only did it result in forced migration and slavery, it also resulted in the loss of culture and our spiritual continuity.
Yes, very interesting. Now, is this a working document? You're not concluded with it yet?
This document a draft of this document is already to the editor going into this book. But like I said, so it's kind of both. So this is going to appear as one of the chapters in the edited book, but it's going to be a standalone, just with regard to historical trauma.
That's excellent. We want to make sure we get a copy of that book. That's for sure. Very good information. Okay, I'm going to go to the panel. Sister Linda, questions, comments?
No, I don't really have a question because it's so interesting. I'm writing all these notes, and of course I have to absorb it. But I want to ask just one quick question. It's another direction. You're talking about the historical trauma. And today's trauma with children in foster care, have you ever even had an opportunity to look into that?
Yes. Correct? And so in that space, we're talking about complex trauma, right? And yes. So in my effort, again, to service the lifespan, I actually consult with the state of Illinois, and I spend a great deal of my time in foster, you know, working in the foster care system. I've been contracting with the state of Illinois for 15 years, specifically to address that. And for the state, I monitor outpatient psychiatric care for the youth in care, and to some degree to the biological parents. I do that statewide, and also am responsible for psychological testing statewide for all youth in care who require testing during inpatient psychiatric admissions. And so I spend a lot of time consulting with case managers and other service providers about the impact of trauma and how the various presentations of trauma get confused with other, you know, other mental health diagnoses. So, for example, this desire to diagnose kids, and this is an issue also in the school systems, this desire to diagnose kids with ADHD. And so it's okay, well, they can't pay attention. Well, a child who's traumatized, by, you know, probably cannot pay attention because their system is reading and perceiving threat and danger. And so they're orienting to the threat and danger. So it's not that that child can't pay attention. The child is not paying attention in class because the child is probably paying attention to the threat and danger. And so having these types of conversations all the time and helping people to kind of understand what it is that they're seeing, you know, or having them understand, you know, dissociation, which is also another common, you know, aspect of trauma. And so the child isn't daydreaming, the child is dissociating. And that's again, you have these breaks from reality because these are adaptive functions that the body does in order to try to keep the mind and body whole, trying to help a person, you know, help a little person in particular, in this case, you know, have some sense of safety. And so, but most people don't understand it that way. And so, you know, they think, you know, they're daydreaming or ADHD or any, you know, any of these other diagnoses, but not really understanding what the impact of trauma is and how trauma itself dysregulates the system so that our fight system, which is really designed to be an adaptive system to keep us safe, can sometimes betray us.
Okay. Linda, anything else?
Oh, no, that was it. Okay. I just want to, because I've heard, and when I worked in the school system, a lot of the children were in foster care, they always recommended Ritalin and those kind of medications.
Yes.
And so I was the only person that was always saying you should not do that.
Mm-hmm. You are correct. And I was actually, I had this conversation the other day. And this actually, this wasn't even with the youth in care. This was actually, but this is how this conversation usually goes. So I was having a conversation with two parents who are divorced, talking about their son. And so they both said, well, we think he has ADHD, but we don't want him on any medicine. I said, okay, I'm fine. If you don't want him on any medicine. I said, but why do you think he has ADHD? And they said, well, he can't pay attention. And he can't pay attention because he's struggling with the effects of the divorce. I said, well, that's not ADHD. And they both were like, well, no, that is ADHD because he can't pay attention. I said, no, that's anxiety. Now, he certainly could have ADHD, but the reason, if he's distracted by your divorce, that's not ADHD. That's as anxiety, and that anxiety certainly could be exacerbating ADHD if he also meets the criteria for ADHD. But the fact that, but if you tell me that that is the reason why he's not paying attention, that's not attention deficit disorder. And so, you know, so a lot of the work that we have to do, period, well, you know, this is period. We got to do this work in the community. We have to do this work in the schools, and we have to do this work definitely for youth and care. Who, you know, youth and care are youth who are involved in child welfare. We really have to do, you know, health literacy work to help people, A, understand, you know, have a language for the, you know, the mental and emotional and the physical experiences that they're having in response to trauma. And B, understand how and where to seek service. And C, you know, kind of what those range of services are. And, you know, but this is a problem kind of across the board that we have to try to meet. But, you know, our children are the most vulnerable. And, you know, again, that's a part of why I spend time in the spaces that I do. I try to be in spaces where I'm able to provide a measure of assistance and comfort to our most vulnerable populations. And so those tend to be our children, and those tend to be folks who comprise the, you know, folks who are, you know, public aid or just uninsured or Medicare, you know. Those groups are the most vulnerable in terms of what's going on in the communities that they live in, what types of resources are available in those communities, and, you know, their relative access to care in response to those things.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Linda. Excellent question. I can see where the parents are thinking one thing, and you're able to educate them about, you know, they're being misunderstood. You know, they don't understand what's really going on. So it's good that you're able to kind of, you know, educate them, because the ignorance leads to more issues. So that's excellent. All right, Brother Mashenda.
Good evening, Dr. Alexander. Thank you
for
your presence tonight. Very interesting. I appreciate your work, what I've heard thus far. Just kind of piggybacking off of Miss Linda Shorter, as far as, you know, the medication, you know, she mentioned Ritalin, you know, and there's a brother, Dr. Umar Johnson, out there. I'm sure you're familiar with him.
Mm-hmm.
Not, you know, and of course, you know, I'm an open-minded individual. You know, you hear different sides of, you know, naysayers and negative and positive about brother, but, you know, this is not my comment. My comment is, you know, I listen to, and it's not just him, it's, you know, I've been working in the systems and working in the education and criminal justice for many years. And what is your take on it? Do you think there's an abuse of, you know, in terms of medication, is there abuse to our children as far as, misdiagnosis or lack of diagnosis or that type of thing? Don't care, just yeah, he's crazy or he's violent or he's this, he's that, put him on medication. What's your take on that, you know, and briefly?
All those things you just said. And so all of that stuff is happening. And you know, so it's always my goal to try to slow the processes down. I was just reading the article, see if I could pull it up while we're on here, just talking about the number of people, period, who are misdiagnosed, you know, while in the hospital, you know, and this is across ages and race and ethnicity, the whole nine. This is just the number of people who are misdiagnosed every year. And so we know this happens. And, you know, that it's so we're very vulnerable once again, because if we are getting service, we're probably not getting served. Like, we're probably more likely to be serviced by a student, you know, a resident or something like that. So just like we look at the school systems, our kids are disproportionately more likely to be taught by a first year teacher, you know, or a teacher that's somewhere between their first and third year. And they're probably working off of their bachelor's. They haven't gone back to school to get their master's yet. And so we get, you know, we get very, very green people into the classrooms teaching our kids. And it's that same thing in mental health. And so if we are able to access care, we are probably being treated by, you know, the least experienced folks. And with regard to, I think, both psychology and psychiatry, Black folks make up less than 2% of all licensed psychologists and psychiatrists. And so, and it's not much different for licensed social workers or professional licensed counselors or counseling psychologists. I mean, there just is not enough of us to meet the demand. And so we are particularly vulnerable. And because people don't always know what they're looking at, and because in addition to the misunderstandings and the misdiagnoses that come as a function of people not understanding the impact or the presentation of trauma, you then also have the impact of white supremacy. So, you know, so if you have, you know, if you have service providers who are at best, you know, just regular old self-absorbed racists versus the, you know, ardent white supremacists, because they, contrary to popular belief, exist in the ivory halls and exist in the hospitals and the medical centers as well. When you have those people who have that level of disdain and disinterest in the people that are in front of them, then the people are necessarily vulnerable. And so all of this stuff happens. And so that's why, you know, so one of my goals all the time, again, you know, I'm pushing health literacy, and I'm pushing health literacy to the community, and I'm pushing health literacy and competency to service providers so that, you know, we can help people out. And so that's treatment and diagnosis, period. And so now when we get to this issue of medication, I am neither absolutely for or against. So I also have a credential in pharmacology. I have a master's in pharmacology. And so, you know, there are circumstances in which the medications can be helpful. But, you know, A, all of these medications have some level of toxicity. And so we have to be mindful of that. B, the medications in and of themselves, I mean, the medications don't do anything in terms of skill building. And so there are far too many people who agree to medications, and some people are even coerced into the medications, thinking that the medication is going to change what is probably a behavioral issue. You know, the medication helps with neurotransmitters. The medication doesn't help with behaviors, and it doesn't help necessarily with thoughts, but, you know, it can have some impact on thoughts. But all of these things are going on, but these are things that people need to know. But we have to slow the processes down and make sure that parents have the best information possible so that they can make informed decisions with regard to the, you know, to the best interests of their children. What I know happens a lot of times is that, you know, schools are telling parents, because again, I do testing, and you know, schools are telling parents, go get your child tested for ADHD Well, the school don't know that the child has ADHD. So the question really should just be, go get the child tested because we have some concerns about his or her ability to pay attention. Right. And so then you let the test circumstance dictate what that diagnosis is, you know. But in those same types of situations, you have schools telling parents that kid can't come back to school until he or she is diagnosed and has medication. Well, to get their kid, you know, to get that child back in the school, the parent now has some, you know, motivation to get this test and this diagnosis and that medication. Right. Now they don't know that, you know, they're not intending to do harm to their son or daughter, but that harm could necessarily occur because in the grand scheme of things, when it is brought to the parent in that manner, it's really a violation of both the parent and the child's rights. And so the school is acting, you know, as a bad actor in that situation. And so we have to slow those processes. And again, we have to slow those processes wherever we find them. We have to sort of, you know, slow those processes. And, you know, if there is a community mental health center, we got to make sure that the people in the community mental health center are culturally competent and they are, you know, ethical and they're clinically sound and that they are given the information necessary so that our parents can make good, sound, you know, and informed decisions on their behalf, you know, on their children's behalf, as well as on their own, or on, you know, for the benefit of themselves, if necessary.
Okay. Can I please add one small thing to that? Let's not forget the parents, because they get a check, and it's sad to say. And they'll,
yeah, so
they'll
we have that too. Absolutely, just
get that check.
Yeah, we have that too. And so, and another thing that we have in child welfare, you know, so you have levels of care in child welfare. And so, you know, you certainly have situations in which you have foster parents, you know, sometimes intentionally and sometimes because they actually don't understand what they're looking at, you know, making all types of assertions about children in the hopes that they could get a higher level of care, which will ultimately result in a higher board pay, right? So, you know, so if this is a traditional foster home, you know, they get a certain rate to host children. And then if they can get a higher designation, a designation of a higher level of care, which in the state of Illinois, we call that specialized care. And I'm not sure, you know, what they call it in other states, but that higher designation means more money. And so there are, you know, these relative financial incentives for biological parents who are seeking checks for social security benefits and for in some circumstances, foster parents who are seeking a boost in their board rate because they could get the child specialized. And so, and again, that's kind of, in the state of Illinois, that's where I come in. And so I have, you know, I have some relative ability to route children for psychiatric evaluations to places that I feel are safe, you know, for the evaluations to occur. And then we have some things in place to make sure that medication isn't starting, you know, that medication is not the first line treatment, that, you know, there has been other interventions involved, you know, and this is primarily for children for five and under, that we make sure that there have been other interventions attempted before medication occurs. And then we see if we can help the child out. And so we have, you know, we actually have a protocol for that. But when I send my children to, so like we have four continuity of care centers. When I send children to the continuity of care center, whether that child, however old that child anywhere from 0 to 18, that's who can get service in the continuity of care center. I know when they go to the continuity of care center, regardless of their age, that that medication is not going to be the frontline service. They're going to try to meet the child's needs through some structural interventions in the placement and through the work that they do in therapy to see if they can, you know, make the necessary adjustments so that medication won't be necessary. And then if medication is necessary, it's just necessary. They then start at the lowest dose and they will, you know, increase or titrate up as necessary, but using, you know, kind of field, generally accepted kind of algorithms to determine what would be the amount appropriate for this child. And so, but the unfortunate thing with the prescribing of medication is that in most cases, and this is across the board, doesn't really matter who the child is that the doctors, well, hey, most medications, most psychotropic medications, those are the mind altering, the intentionally mind altering medications. So those are medications that are prescribed for psychosis, mood disturbance, and, you know, the whole nine. Most of those medications are prescribed by primary care physicians. Okay. And so primary care physicians aren't trained to prescribe psychotropic medications. So that's a problem, but I kind of know how it happens and why it happens. B, neither primary care physicians or psychiatrists have a really in-depth means for diagnosis. So a lot of times diagnosis is based on, when we're talking about kids, diagnosis can be based on, you know, the parents' observations or just, you know, whatever the parent narrative about the kid is otherwise. And, you know, in the prescribing professionals, a lot of time they take that and they utilize that. And, you know, they may talk to the young person too, but they weigh heavily on the adult's perception of what's going on. And they then prescribe free of any, you know, any like objective data or any statistical data that might be provided as a result of actually testing that youth to find out if there are actual statistically significant levels of cognitive impairment or, you know, emotional impairment or something of that nature. And so this thing gets very, very tricky. And, but again, this is another aspect of health literacy. We just have to make sure that people understand and know what it is they're seeing, what it is that they're hearing. We have to make sure that everybody, not just children, but everybody in a lifespan, we have to make sure that people have the language necessary to explain what it is that they are experiencing. One of the things that's very common for me, you know, in some of the work that I do and some of the conversations that I'm having, you know, I ask a person, you know, so how are you feeling? Well, you know, such and such did this and such did that, and, you know, and I feel a certain kind of way, you know, so that's a mental health. That's a mental health statement for some people. I feel a certain kind of way, right? We need for people to be able to say I'm mad, sad, angry, you know, indifferent, whatever it is. We got to help people understand that feeling a certain kind of way, he on one, he tweaking, you know, those aren't mental health diagnoses. I mean, not diagnoses, but symptoms. And so when you say those things, you know, it's no telling what kind of help you're going to get in response. And so we need to have people understand, you know, or have the language for what it is that they're experiencing. And then we also need to have people understand where you get help. And so, what's the difference between going to a psychologist and a psychiatrist? Okay, so a psychiatrist is a medical doctor. A psychologist either has a PhD or, in my case, a PsyD. A PhD is a doctorate in philosophy with an emphasis in psychology. A PsyD is a doctorate in clinical psychology. You know, so we have to have people understand those things so they know where to go to get whatever the services are that they need. If I just need therapy, do I need to talk to a a psychiatrist, a PsyD, or can I talk to the social worker? Well, you could talk to the social worker. And so, you know, if, you know, and you could talk to a counselor also. So you can talk to a counselor, you can talk to a social worker, and you could probably talk to a psychologist. And then there are some psychiatrists who actually do therapy, but not many. And so we have people languishing, though, on the wait list for those psychiatrists who do therapy when there is a social worker who could have seen them, but they don't understand because they think that's where they got to go. And so we have to make sure that people understand how and where to access service. We have to make sure that people understand and have the language to describe whatever their symptoms are. And we have to make sure that people have access.
That's heavy. Yeah, it's pretty deep. Yes. Wow. Okay, Professor Rob.
Oh, wow. This is nice travel. First of all, appreciate what's been said, if I understand correctly. What is the definition of trauma?
So trauma is really not a very complex definition. I mean, trauma is any event that causes impairment in your thinking, your feeling, or your behavior. I mean, that's just it in a nutshell. Right. And go ahead.
What was the prognosis?
Kind of depends on what the trauma is and who the person who's experiencing the trauma. The people who are most vulnerable to trauma are people who were already vulnerable before the trauma. So people who were already exposed to less than optimal living conditions, if something traumatic happens, they are more likely to be traumatized. And their ability to rebound from the trauma, again, kind of dependent on what the trauma is then attached to their ability to identify or be identified and then have access to competent care. And so you know, if they can receive that, you know, it's a pretty good chance. You know, again, we got to be mindful of whatever it is that happened and, you know, kind of whatever else is going on in the people's lives. But, you know, there's this concept called plasticity. And so the brain will adapt and can adapt. And so there are many things that through the course of, you know, just consistent services, you know, people can regain, you know, their cognitive abilities, their emotional abilities, and be able to function in a productive manner. But it really just kind of comes down to access to care, and that is still even greatly impacted by whatever was going on with that person prior to the trauma.
Do coping skills help a person if he develops their own coping skills to deal with the various categories?
That's a great question, Berlin. And because, I mean, so like one of the things that people don't understand is that the trauma response is really the body's built-in coping mechanisms. And so the issues, you know, kind of arises, again, it's kind of like what was going on before and, you know, during and then after as to whether or not those innate skills that your body is just going to do because that's how we're built, you know, our autonomic nervous system, which is comprised of our sympathetic and our parasympathetic nervous system. Our sympathetic nervous system is the fight or flight piece that helps us to orient toward danger and either fight or flee. And if we cannot avoid that danger, if we cannot escape that danger, in some circumstances, it might be more appropriate to freeze. And so that's an adaptive process. But once dysregulation occurs, people can get stuck in either one of those phases. They can get stuck and freeze. They can get stuck in flight, or they can get stuck in fight. And so one of the things that happens is that we have a lot of pathologizing of the body's natural response to threat, when in reality, what we're looking at are adaptive mechanisms that are that our bodies do. And so that's one piece. Now back to the broader issue of coping skills. Yes, for many people, the issue is, can we teach them, you know, can we teach them the range of skills necessary for them to be able to respond to their environment and whatever the environmental stressors are? Can we teach them the skills necessary, you know, and if we're talking again specifically about traumatized people, can we teach them the skills necessary, you know, those skills of discernment, so that they can appropriately distinguish between, you know, real threats versus those things that simply remind them of the previous trauma, right? So can we help them to regulate and to be calm and thoughtful and be able to make the decisions necessary to keep themselves safe and not overreact, or in situations where it does require that they get out of that piece, are they able to move, or are they frozen by the circumstance?
Okay, let me go back to Mashinda. I don't think he finished his questions. And then I'll just conclude with two questions. Go ahead, Mashinda.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, he has his hand up. Did you have some more questions?
Well, not really. I was just, you know, listening to what he was saying.
You had your hand up.
I don't know if I put a hand up or not.
Okay. Well,
Go ahead and finish.
Okay. The other thing is that when it comes to, we've had some great, first of all, you know, like, you know, it's not that many black psychologists. I mean, there's not that many black doctors in any field. And so, you know, and sometimes we have Dr. Amos Wilson. I know you're familiar with his work. I like to believe. He said we are unique. But is there such a thing as, one psychologist once said, I mean, and Naeem Akbar, you know, when he said break the chains of the mental chains.
Psychological slavery.
Yes, in the community itself. He argued that it's abnormal for black people not to have trauma and stress in a racist dynamic. What role do you think, because you went into the history of going all the way back, and sometimes, you know, the terms have changed. Very few historians would say slave trade. They would say the Holocaust of enslavement. Second, they would call it human trafficking, not slave trade, no matter who was doing it. You know, even if you catch a brother misusing a young girl, taking her around, pimping her, that's human trafficking in its nature as well.
And that's what it's referred to in my article. Yep.
Yeah. And the same thing with regards to going all the way back. Then there was a lot of people that said that a lot of the imposition of Christianity and under the auspices of Christianity, I'm not saying they were Christians doing it, they claimed they were, Muslims who claimed they were, really used violence on the continent. Because I think Chancellor Williams talked about miscegenation they mixed, of course, and then they began to use war and things of this nature. So my question is that under the auspices of oppression, if there is a term, oppression, psychoneurosis, and today's black youth or black people who are having mental breakdowns that are reflective in homelessness, Indiscriminate violence. You know, the abuse of themselves and others. Does do you treat that psychological problem as a symptom of trauma, or caused by trauma, or just caused by just a mental breakdown or emotional breakdown, or just I don't know. I mean, you know, from your standpoint, because, you know, courts sometimes require people to go, you know, people plead insanity. You know, I mean, what is the degree of measurement that you would gauge in?
And I also appreciate that last piece that you said, you know, very, I think one of the things that we all have to understand is that it's insanity. That's a court term. That's a legal term, right? People think that that's a mental health term, and it's not. That's a legal term, and it really has nothing to do with mental health necessarily. It is about a person's ability to discern right from wrong. So appreciate that statement, Baba. And then, but to your question. This is really kind of gets to the core of why I wrote the article and where I want to go with the concept, and that, you know, for us, and I agree with Naeem Akbar, it would be, and this is kind of the purview from which I practice, it would be an indication that something is wrong if we are not having a psychological response to global white supremacy. This is what our system is designed to do. It is designed to identify and orient towards the threat. And so you start to see a range of behaviors that are occurring in response to the oppressive conditions that we live in. And so, there are certainly some other factors that are included in that, which will, you know, some more proximal factors than the actual supremacists that will, you know, greatly influence, you know, how it is played out. And so one of the fundamental things that exists or occurs as a result of this thing, so you mentioned Naeem Akbar. I like to also expose people to the thoughts of Kobe Cambon, who espouses that the most fundamental form of mental illness for Black folks is psychological misorientation. And that's what comes with human trafficking. And that's what I'm talking about in the article. I'm talking about how our fundamental sense of self has been stolen and disrupted, right? And so, and we see this over centuries, over hundreds, thousands of years. And so we get to this space, we're looking at complex trauma. We're looking at the compounded impacts, you know, of this historical trauma. Every year, every day, you know, every moment, every day of every week, of every month, of every year, there is something happening to us somewhere, either individually or collectively. And those things add up, right? And our point of reference has been skewed by the aggressor. And so we start to do things that either mirror the aggressor. Well, a lot of what we do mirrors the aggressor. And to the degree that the aggressor typically does not have boots on the ground other than in the form of a paramilitary force that we call the police, we act out on those people who are closest to us. And so all of these things are a function of that historical trauma that then become complex traumas that we experience on a day-to-day.
I got it.
Okay. Well, this has been great, man. And, you know, because I like I said, dealing with the mental, you know, like what Linda's question was, you know, you have a large percentage of Black people living with not just in foster care, but with not with their biological parents.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them do it just for the money. And then, you know, they say that's one of the highest amount of homelessness is Black people 18.
Yes.
So, you know, that right there, facing 18, you 17, 18, and you ain't got yourself together, but people saying you're going to have to leave here because I got to get another kid, you know.
Yeah, and so we have, you know, to your point, so we have a significant number of children who, you know, so if they're in college, if they're enrolled in college, they can continue, you know, they can stay in care until they're like 21 or 23. If they don't go to college, then they age out the system at 18. And, if return home wasn't an option for them for whatever reason, a lot of those youth, you know, a significant number of those youth end up homeless. Even youth who prior to aging out, even those youth who were in like transitional living placements, we call those TLPs, and those are their living circumstances, you know, probably apartment living. Youth have, they have freedom. You know, they work in the community, they go to school in the community, and they live in an apartment setting with mm-hmm. other youth. And there's probably an adult on the premises, but, you know, all the youth have their own, you know, their own rooms and apartments and things of that nature. The goal of those programs, and also we have programs called independent living programs where youth are actually in apartments that are just in the community. The goal of those programs is that, you know, from the time that youth is placed there to the time that youth is 18 and or graduates from college, that they're learning the independent living skills that will allow them to function in the community and be a productive member of the community and be able to act on, you know, on their own best, on their own behalf in a manner that's going to keep them safe, excuse me, and in their best interest. But again, that is as good as the service provider. And so if we don't have good service providers, if the service providers, like some of the foster parents, are just kind of in this for the money, then, you know, we have a lot of those kids that go into those programs and they come out of those programs the same ill-equipped and ill-prepared as they were when they went in. And so they then end up a part of the homeless population.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, man, deep, but we'd like that. I'd like to get some more with you, so I'll be communicating with you.
I'll be back whenever you are. Right. I appreciate it very much. Having Thank the opportunity you. To be here.
Yes, sir. Yeah, so, Brother Mashenda, did you want to get that question in?
Well, like I said, I would just, you know, in the midst of listening to him when I was, basically, my experience, like working in the criminal industrial complex, as I call it, as it relates to juveniles, you know, some of those many, many cases that were being adjudicated, you know, kids from the neighborhood who, from my point of view and what I was doing in my experience before all of that, you know, what I deem as ridiculous sometimes in terms of outcomes and dispositions of what happens to that child. You know, if you're in the criminal system, you're being labeled as a gang member, being labeled as violent. So anyway, in my experience, had to go before the courts, had to present psychiatric or psychological evaluations in many cases, and go before a screening committee, and people that don't look like me who's making decisions, you know, not to say that people that don't look like me can't make a decision. You know, I can't just be all, you know, it's absolute. But I do know that a high percentage, you know, what I saw was kind of a cookie cutter type of response to, in other words, if you're a gang member and you're trying to, and, you know, so as far as these enhancements, what these kids get to determine their outcome, where they're going to be placed, whether it be a group home or a lockdown facility and so forth. So the ones that was charged with me, I did my best to do outside. I used to, you know, it cost the agency, you know, extra money to get a private or an outside evaluation. And it was a good thing that, you know, there was a brother that was, you know, in the neighborhood who was a, you know, a clinical psychologist who did a lot of the evaluations. And so, in other words, you know, trying to make the diet, you know, the outcome or the diagnosis, I guess, in terms of whatever the psychological or psychiatric evaluation was trying to prove or disprove, you know, it was easy for them to say, oh, well, this person's violent. Let's send him, we're going to give him, you know, 3 years in California Youth Authority, something like that. Whereas I know personally, this, not only this kid is not hardcore, and, you know, and of course I did many social studies where I have to learn the family environment and things like that, and based on my research. So in other words, if I didn't go outside of the government agencies, psychologists that they had working there, you know, so a lot of our kids are caught up in this system and it repeats itself over and over again. You know, so I stayed in it as long as I could to try to, you know, help as many. But a lot of things changed, you know, became more pro-law enforcement, got away from more of the therapeutic. And then, of course, overall, they're saying now, you know, they're getting rid of a lot of the lockdown facilities. And, you know, it's a lot of other things going on. But, you know, that's after my time. But during my time, I'm just saying they were sending them through the mill. And so I had a hand in trying to, you know, make sense out of each child that came through there. So that's why I appreciate your efforts, is because what I'm hearing is that, you know, you're a voice, you're a mind, you're an expert, or, you know, you're a conscious authority on what you're doing to try to help, you know, an individual. Because, you know, it's not a one size fit all cookie cutter situation, which, you know, what I witnessed, and there was people that looked like you and I, who are just allowing that to go on, but not on my watch. So I appreciate you, brother. And I'm gonna leave it at that. And I was gonna ask you about dyslexia, you know, learning, different learning styles in the classroom. Kid might have dyslexia or something else going on, and they get, they say, you know, oh, we're gonna throw him in special ed, when they have schools of dyslexia that actually train them with their learning style, and they go to college and be very successful. And, you know, that kind of thing. So I just threw some stuff out there, man. So your response.
And thank you, Bob and Machinda. To that first part that you were talking about. So the state of Illinois, I think the state of Illinois contracts with about 20 psychologists. So I'm one of 20 psychologists. And I'm responsible for statewide outpatient psychiatric services for youth and care and some parents, and I'm responsible statewide for psychological testing for youth who are currently in inpatient facilities. And then I also do, I think it's about five of us that do what's called secure care assessments. And this kind of speaks to what you're talking about, Bob Machinda, in which, you know, we're getting youth and care from the juvenile detention calendar. And so we're having, like, some of these youth are actually in correctional facilities and we go in and we interview them and we write clinical reports and make recommendations about again, the level of care or what type of facility or placement that they would most likely succeed in, which could range from, you know, a secure or locked clinical facility, you know, or a regular, traditional residential placement, a group home, or could they actually step down to a foster placement or return home? Now, they almost never can go from the correctional, you know, from the detention to a foster placement, but they can go from, you know, they could go from the correctional the Department of Corrections to a residential or a group home and then to foster placement. But we have an opportunity in those spaces to advocate, you know, for children and even in circumstances in which, you know, their behaviors and their relationships and ties make it necessary for us to, you know, in order to keep the youth safe and other people safe, there are just necessarily times where we have to make a recommendation that youth go to a locked clinical facility. And so our decision is not to put that child, like, we don't get to weigh in on whether or not that child goes to another detention center or to any kind of actual carceral spot. But we do get to make a decision when necessary that if that child needs to reside in a locked clinical facility, because that is the only place where he or she could be maintained long enough for the effects of therapy and treatment to ultimately, you know, kind of settle in. You know, we do that and we seek to do that, you know, in the most ethical and an effective manner. And so that, you know, that we do and that I do. And I like doing it. And I also think that is a part of my responsibility to be able to utilize my skills in a manner that allows me to advocate most for, again, the most vulnerable. And so that's that part of your question. Now, so like the special education piece, this is another thing where we really have to make sure that our parents and our families have the adequate health literacy. And so health literacy doesn't, you know, it's not just about knowing the name of words, knowing words and definitions. It is also about having a full understanding of, you know, the services available. And so, if a child has, you know, dyslexia or some other type of specific reading or learning disability, you know, if it's a concern that, you know, that is occurring, you know, the parent, you know, has to make a request in writing to the school district to have a case study evaluation conducted. And then if it is determined that that child meets the criteria for that, then the school is required to meet his or her educational needs. And they do that through an individual education plan. And so a lot of times parents don't want that individual education plan because they think it's, you know, they only really think it's a labeling piece. But in reality, you know, to the degree that we can make sure that this is done, you know, in an ethical manner and with efficacy, if the child meets the criteria, it is in the best interest of that child to have that individual education plan for reasons that Brother Lashinda mentioned, is that if that child keeps that plan and, you know, for as long as that plan is necessary and valid, you know, that child could use that plan to go on to college and get the necessary accommodations to have success in college as well. And so the whole point of it, again, is to make sure that whatever the identified disability is not the reason why that child is not able to successfully complete high school or college. It is the responsibility of the educational facility, you know, once made aware that this youth has an individual education plan, to put the services in place necessary to bridge the gap between the effects of the disability and what's necessary for that child to have success otherwise.
Excellent information.
My experience with schools, a lot of school systems in particular, you know, the ones I've dealt with, they don't, you know, I mean, some of them, at a bare minimum, they will, you know, they have to, like you say, they, by law, they have to acknowledge the IEP, the accommodations and things like that. But what I'm finding is too, it is depending on where you're at, but a lot of schools, they, you know, the teachers don't find time to really deal with that. You know, they do, of course, I mean, it really is a gross negligence that's going on. You know, I know firsthand. And, I work with ADA, you know, I'm a contact person where I work at a college. And so you're right with that IEP. We take that IEP and use it from high school and things like that. But what I'm finding is, if, you know, a lot of people, I guess the bottom line is, people aren't as aggressive as I would like them to be based on what I know. And, you know, I'm not, like I say, we can be negative all day. There are people that are different levels of know-how, and they got, sometimes they do the best they can within the resources they got. I understand that. But at the end of the day, a lot of kids fall through the cracks because, although it may, a lot of it goes unidentified, because, you know, you may have parents that don't understand that. They don't, you know, like you say, they, you know, I know that the, like where I work at, they have to bring it to our attention that they need accommodations. I can't go out and solicit. However, you know, it's like, wait a minute. Some, you know, when you know there's a problem, it's like you almost want to solicit. Like, hey, anybody got any problems? Can you read? Can you, do you write your D's backwards? You know, that kind of thing. But, you know, like I say, we don't do that. But it's almost like, I don't know, at a K-12, it's like kids, and I work K-12, where it's kids are just lumped into a basket sometimes, where, hey, you're special ed. And like you say, kids might, or, you know, then they get 504 or whatever. But the point is, it's like a lot of the teachers, they're not even equipped to deal with it. Now, if you say, hey, they can read aloud, you know, these accommodations, sure, they can do that. But I find that a lot of, you know, there's a lot of educators out there that feel, you know, like, I'm left-handed, so I'm in a right-handed world. It's like, you just get used to opening that door that way, you know, and hey, this is the way it is. And, you know, I just find it unfair. But like I said, I appreciate you for all you do, man. I could talk all day. I'm off the air.
Thank you again, brother. And, but you make another great point. And again, this is, I mean, I just cannot overemphasize this issue of health literacy. And, you know, so the other thing with the IEP is as good as not just the educators, it is as good as the parent. The parent still has to do some work once that child gets that individual education plan to make sure that the youth is getting the related services or the accommodations as dictated by the plan. And so I had a conversation with a parent just this past week where, you know, the son, he has a learning disability, and part of it is his reading. I don't think his reading is at grade level, and so he's failing driver's ed. And so I was like, well, why are you failing driver's ed? And he's like, well, I don't like the classroom work. And I was like, well, are you getting the accommodations? How are they presenting the work? And he don't know if he's getting accommodations or not. And then the mom was like, well, I might need to check. But yeah, sister, you always got to know. Whatever classroom he's in, you have to figure out, you have to ask the questions about the degree to which his IEP, you know, applies to this particular instructional level or medium or what have you. And so, but we have to make sure that parents understand that. Now, that being said, we also have to understand that school was traumatic for some of our parents. So some of our parents are school, you know, so, you know, so we had this thing called school phobia, right? So where you had kids who don't want to go to school, they're avoiding school for whatever reason. We have parents like that, right? So sometimes the parents are not available, you know, are not able to help their children. They're not available or able to help their children in some of these circumstances because they have their own, you know, residual traumas from their own academic circumstances. So we have to be mindful of that as well. And so, you know, we have to, you know, really kind of bridge the gap or at least kind of get these things out. Like when we're seeing this, you know, because a lot of times those things kind of accrue in a negative manner to the child, you know. So if a parent is supposed to come to the school for this, that, or the other, and, you know, they're like, this parent never comes. Well, maybe the parent don't come because they work three jobs, right? Maybe the parent doesn't come because you don't have a nice school. And the only reason that their kid is here because you're the kid in the district and the parent is not comfortable coming up here, you know, or maybe it is just simply because the parent has a historical history, you know, their recollection, their memories of high school, you know, or school period, you know, their recollection of school period is traumatic. And so they have an avoided kind of attachment to the school setting, you know, but they send their child, but they don't feel, you know, comfortable or competent enough to go there and advocate, you know, for their child. Well, that parent needs advocacy too, right? So we have to, you know, where we find those situations, we got to advocate for the parent and for the child, you know, but we got to find them. We got to look for those opportunities to do good and help the people.
Excellent. Excellent. I just wanted to share just what you're talking about, that how the parents negatively transfer their vibe to their children. I have on the website, I have perspective writings, and here's one of them that speaks about just what you're talking about. And it's called Positive Math Perspective, the Elimination of Negativity. The parents can transfer that negativity to the students. And one of the examples is, I don't like math, you know. You know, I never was good in math. And then the child is constantly hearing this, and they take on this personality. So that was very interesting. So yeah, on the website we have numerous perspective writings that address some of the issues that's being discussed this evening. So that's excellent. Excellent, excellent. So definitely, Dr. Charles, we want to get you back on here, you know, and I'm pretty sure Professor Ra want to get you on Conscious Corner. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we definitely want to get you back on here. It's very in-depth information and very useful, you know, especially with the parents thinking that, you know, it's one diagnosis and you have to clarify, no, I'm that's not it. You know, it's just excellent information. So I really appreciate you coming on here, and we definitely want to have you back.
Again, brother, I appreciate the opportunity, and I look forward to coming back again. And Baba Amara, I found my Dr. King books. I found and I found The African Origin of Biological Psychiatry. Yes, sir. Right. So,
hey, listen.
And I got Naeem Akbar up on the shelf too, and Amos Wilson. I got it all. This is
And you mentioned what's the African brother name? Black Psychology book.
Kobe Cambon.
Kobe, yeah.
I got him up there too.
And, yeah, you had found the article. You had mentioned the article in your first presentation of misdiagnosis in hospitals.
Yes.
Would you send that to Rasha Key?
Yes, I will.
So he can send it to us? Because yes, we have a lot of people that deal with homeopathic treatment, and they're always pointing out bad doctors and bad medicine. We need that. All right, then, brother. Rasha Key, when's our next meeting? Monday. I mean, we meet tomorrow in the book, but are we going next Monday?
Oh yeah, only way we won't go is if you tell us we're not doing it next.
I want to have a panel discussion on the psychological development of the Black child.
Okay.
And I want you to be on it as well as Linda probably and the whole panel discuss it.
Okay, well, if Dr. Charles can stop by on Monday, we'll be here talking about that.
The same site?
Yeah. Psychological. I'm gonna be coming from Amos Wilson and Francis Press Wilson perspective on psychological development of the Black child.
Absolutely. Brother Rashiki, I just sent you that article. The article about the misdiagnosis.
Okay, so next week, folks, on the CEN show, next Wednesday, Brother Thomas is gonna host. So we're gonna have Brother Thomas take over. And he's going to host next week, and he's going to talk about a few things. So that'll be good to have Brother Thomas come on. He's one of our team members. So I appreciate everybody this evening and the contribution. And so we're going to say, like we always say, each one teach one in Conscious Corner. And everybody have a good evening.
All right. Good evening. Take it easy in Chicago, brother.